listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And there's a lot going on in the world. We're going to get to much of it as we continue through the program. But first, Dr. Betsy McCoy has been popping up on Fox News a lot lately, talking about how the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, is going to eviscerate Medicare. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this. Dr. McCoy is a conservative commentator, author of Beating Obamacare, Your Handbook for Surviving the New Healthcare Law, former lieutenant governor of New York State. Her website, Betsy McCoy, it's spelled MCCAUGHEY.com. Also a former member of the board of directors of Cantel Medical and, oh, there's some other company in here. Anyway, Betsy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. You forgot my blood type.
Well, you know, here's my question. You make this compelling argument that you used to make a compelling argument that there were death panels in Obamacare. I haven't heard that in a while, but now you're running around saying, look out, seniors, beware. You know, this is going to take all this money away from Medicare. And I'm wondering why. Not why you're saying this, but why would anybody who has to answer to the people every 2 years in an election, why would they write a piece of legislation that's going to rip the guts out of Medicare? Our program conservatives have always loved to hate, but nonetheless, a program that's very popular. Why would they do that?
There's no question that that's what's being done. If you look at the government's own projections, the reports from the Congressional Budget Office,
No, I've got your understanding, your interpretation of that. I acknowledge that
right,
that is
no
your position on that. I'm wondering why you think the people who put together the Affordable Care Act did this incredibly malicious thing against people over 65. Why would they do that?
Because they didn't believe that it would be, that people would understand why health care, especially for seniors, was deteriorating so rapidly. What the law does is, it's right here on my desk, great big law, over half of it is paid for with cuts to Medicare. They took $716 billion out of Medicare and moved it over to fund a very big expansion, a vast expansion of Medicaid. It's like robbing grandma.
As I said, I've heard you say that and I could debate it with you if you want. I mean, it actually reduces future Medicare spending by $500 billion, lowers the growth rate of payments by $219 billion, if you want to get specific about it. So it's actually $719 billion.
Old numbers.
But, okay, well, whatever numbers. Let's right. just assume that what you're saying is absolutely true. I asked the question, why would these largely Democratic legislators, although there were Republicans who helped put this thing together in the Senate in particular, why would they do something that is so terrible to old people? And
because
the answer that you just gave me was because they
money.
Thought that old people wouldn't realize that
yes,
it was happening.
Right. They thought it was
so,
easy money if you raise taxes.
So why would they do something that, I mean, why would they feel the need to do something on the assumption that people wouldn't realize
because
that they were doing
easier,
it?
Easier politically than raising taxes more. What this law does is it raised taxes about $500 billion over the course of the decade, and it takes, as I said, $716 billion out of Medicare.
But, Betsy, an overwhelming majority of the American people, well over 50% of the American people in any study you ask, are in favor of raising taxes on rich people and corporations in America.
Well, but it's not just rich people. You can't get enough money out of rich people.
You certainly could.
Well, no. Let me just explain. If you last January, the president raised the payroll tax.
That's not rich people. That's people
That's
making under $113,000 a year.
Why did he do that? Because there isn't enough money to pay for all these government programs just taxing rich people.
No, he did that because they had cut back on they had reduced the payroll tax over a short period of time in order to stimulate the economy, and that reduction expired.
That's right.
This has nothing to do with some nefarious program, and it wasn't actually raising taxes on working people.
The net effect was people had less money in their paycheck once that change was made. They could have continued at the lower rate, but they didn't.
So let me get this straight. Democrats conspired to screw old people because they figured the old people wouldn't figure it out. Now it's coming into effect. The law is coming into effect There's going to be an election next year. There's going to be an election 2 years after that, 2 years after that, 2 years after that. Is this going to be the end of the Democratic Party?
Not at all. We don't know what's going to happen in the election. I don't know. I'm hoping that 2014 will be a referendum on the Obama health law, and people will go to the polls and vote for members of Congress who are committed to repealing this law, because it's very damaging to health care, especially seniors' health care.
So, number one, Democrats did this because they figured old people wouldn't figure it out. And then number two, they did it because it was easier than raising taxes. Democrats have always wanted to raise taxes.
That's right, but it's tougher to do that. It's tougher to raise taxes.
Over what? Republican objections?
Provide the money from one group to another.
It's tougher to raise taxes over Republican objections, you mean?
It's tougher to raise taxes, period. There are always repercussions to raising taxes. But moving money from one program to another...
Franklin Roosevelt raised taxes, raised the income tax from 25% to 91%. He got reelected three times.
That's true. It was a very different environment.
Well, yeah, people, you know, our economy had been crashed by a bunch of banksters, and we had levels of inequality that are identical to today.
I think what you really ought to look at is what the repercussions of taking this money out of future Medicare spending is.
Well, you know, let's assume that they're just as absolutely horrible as you say, and that, you know, terrible things are going to happen, and Granny's going to get pushed off that cliff, and it's not Paul Ryan who's doing it, it's President Obama. There will be no political survival for the Democratic Party if that happens, and I'm still trying to figure out, you're a smart woman, Betsy, why, you know, I can understand, you know, I understand, for example, Billy Towson, you know, we even had him on this program. He shepherded through Medicare Part D during the Bush administration. The Republicans were pushing this. You know, let's give pharmaceuticals to old people under Medicare. They didn't put it on the budget. We're not going to pay for it. We're just going to add it to the deficit. And we're not going to let Medicare negotiate the price of those pharmaceuticals the way that Walmart does or the way that the Army does. They have to pay full retail. And so this was a $600 billion gift to the pharmaceutical industry. I understand why Billy Towson did that. He went to the Speaker of the House and asked for special permission to leave the House of Representatives 4 months early so he could take a $2 million job, a year job as the CEO of Pharma, the lobbying company for the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I get that. That's fairly obvious. There's a quid and there's a pro quo. You know, quid and a quo. What's the, you know, what
no,
is it, what's in it
I
for the Democrats to do
politics.
This to people?
I'm not in it for the politics. I'm looking at the impact on health care.
I understand that, but why, let's,
don't
if we could
me,
understand
me,
why they
show.
Did this horrible thing, maybe we could
but
do something about
explain,
it. Why did them,
Medicare
Democrats
Part D
do
is
this?
A very good thing. Medicare Part D is a very good thing, and let me explain why. Because if you have health insurance and you don't have coverage for drugs, in this day and age, you really don't have health insurance.
I agree with you.
You're an elderly person and you can't.
I agree with you, but do you think it's a good thing that the government not be allowed to negotiate pharmaceutical prices?
That's not the issue.
Okay, but that was my point. I can find, you know, a motivation for these things. Medicare Part D was a good thing. The Republicans thought they'd get some benefit from it. They did, presumably. I mean, you know, they won an election after that. George Bush bragged about it. God bless them. They did what the people want. Why would the Democrats do something so villainous?
As I explained, the villainous aspect of what they're doing is trying to shift money out of one program to another.
Right, but why?
Ignoring the impact on seniors.
But why?
They have simply ignored the terrible impact on seniors. And rather than arguing with you about the politics, I'd like to explain to your listeners what we know about that impact, because Richard Foster, the chief actuary of Medicare, he worked for the...
Betsy, your website... I'm sorry to interrupt you. We have hard breaks. I have no control over the break. I'm not trying to cut you off. But let me tell our viewers and our listeners, there's a ton of this information on Betsy's website. You can read it. Her last name, McCoy, is spelled M-C-C-A-U-G-H-E-Y. It's BetsyMcCoy.com. Betsy, Dr. Betsy McCoy, thank you for dropping by.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm still trying to figure this out. Why would the Democrats be so dastardly? What evil lurks at the heart of Barack Obama? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nate Sweet, producer with the Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Great, great. Anyhow, so we're going to start out with a time to bail the jail of banksters and Matt Taibbi. Matt Taibbi is one of my favorite. He and Li Fang are the two best investigative reporters working in America right now.
Yeah, Matt is just awesome. I don't know if any of your viewers have ever read his book, Griftopia, which is sort of a history of the financial crisis and how it started. He's brilliant at taking complicated things and making them sound really obvious and simple. So he's going to break down the J.P. Morgan settlement for us and really tell us why it's not as bad as a lot of people in the mainstream financial press and the Wall Street Journal and CNBC say it is. So it's going to be definitely interesting to hear his take on that.
Yeah, and not to give it away, but let me give it away. Basically, what he is going to lay out, and he's going to explain it to you in a way that you can tell your friends about it tomorrow, is that what Bernie Madoff did with his Ponzi scheme and what Jamie Dimon did at J.P. Morgan with mortgages was essentially the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're both defrauding investors. Bernie Madoff just happened to defraud rich, Wall Street insiders, and J.P. Morgan happened to defraud mom-and-pop investors like you and me, so they got off. Bernie Madoff didn't.
Yeah, there you go. So I guess the lesson is, don't steal Steven Spielberg's money.
Right.
Instead.
Or the New York Mets owner.
Yeah, there you go. So then innocent victims of drones speak out. Congressman Alan Grayson, who has brought this grandmother the children of the grandmother who was killed, right?
Yeah, their mother was killed. Pakistan. They're victims of U.S. drone strike. Right. This is in conjunction with Robert Greenwald, whose new film, Unmanned, focuses on the victims of U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan. He and Alan Grayson have got together. They've brought this family to the United States. They spoke in front of a congressional briefing today. Alan's going to come on and talk about that and some of the work he's doing to push back against the drone war. It's really amazing when you think that this family came all the way to the U.S., to the country of their family's relatives' killers, and spoke out. I think it's pretty admirable. Really brave.
It's pretty extraordinary. I agree. And then Rusty Humphries, Nicole Williams, and Matt Purple. Has Matt been on the show before? That seems like a new name to me.
This is the first time I've seen him since I've been at the show. So they'll be on. We'll be talking about drones. We'll be talking about the latest, the ongoing NSA revelations. And Dianne Feinstein has interestingly come out against the idea of spying on American allies, which is ironic given that she gave such a full-throated defense of spying on American allied or the citizens of allied countries. So we'll sort of delve into that contradiction.
Well, she's come out against spying on heads of state, hasn't
right.
she? But
right,
she's not
right.
come out against spying on average people.
No, she actually thinks that's totally fine.
Yeah, well, she is a head of state, so arguably. So, this is still the old, the kings and the castles, you never target the king's headquarters in the castle.
Yeah, give the political class immunity from every single possible thing.
Right.
Just another symptom of that. And we'll also be talking about Obamacare. There's controversy today that some people may see changes on Obamacare, but, a lot of that is mainstream media hoopla. We'll delve into that. It's actually maybe a good thing to separate or changing the way individual plans are worked out. That's one of the benefits of Obamacare. Nobody's really talking about it in that way.
Right. And then also superstorms is the new normal.
Mm-hmm. Year
and
Hurricane Sandy.
Yep. And our best of the rest of the Republican war on food stamps.
Yeah.
Very good. Nate Sweet. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
And we will be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. Let me stipulate, for the record, that Obamacare does not, in my opinion, does not cut $700 billion from Medicare. It actually reduces future Medicare, the increasing rate of future Medicare spending through a variety of mechanisms, a lot of them being making things more efficient, streamlining things. Changing payments lowers the growth rate of payments to hospitals and healthcare providers. More than a third of the so-called cuts come from reductions in the money that has been given by the federal government to organizations like United Healthcare for the so-called Medicare Advantage plans, which is privatization of Medicare. So we're dialing back on the privatization of Medicare. And, some people, including Betsy McCoy, are calling that cutting Medicare. I call that good. But nonetheless, I still don't understand what evil lurks in the heart of President Obama, that he would want to, you know, create death panels. I mean, I guess that's been debunked. And now the new one is he would want to destroy Medicare. This, you know, and by the way, it's the Republic. This is a Republican talking point that Obama wants to destroy Medicare. While the budget that's sitting in the House of Representatives right now that Paul Ryan pushed through voucherizes Medicare. What am I missing here? Maybe you know, Kurt. Kurt, in Indianola, Iowa. Hey, Kurt.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. You want to clear up some Medicare myths, you said?
Well, I really appreciate it, Tom. All your I watch your show about every day. I work out on the treadmill, and I watch it at the same time. So
that's a great combination.
Mind and body.
Yeah.
But, I think this thing is... I'm a senior. I've been on Medicare for a number of years, and you have rightfully pointed out how the insurance industry continues to try to weaken original Medicare.
Right.
And now I am bombarded by all these so-called Advantage plans, and a lot of those, they have no premium, but if you look at the copays and out-of-pocket limits, they're clearly not a good insurance policy.
Right.
And so consequently, the other thing that Medicare Part D, I'm agreeing with you on that too, is nothing but a farce. I have to be on it because of my coverage, but I think it's paid out $200 this year and hasn't covered most of my drugs. And so, yeah, I think we need to cut back and pare back those Advantage plans, and I also think we need to continue to fight the cost increases because they're consuming people. They just don't have the income to continue to pay more out of pocket.
Right. And meanwhile, UnitedHealthcare's CEO, Stephen Hemsley, has taken over $1 billion in compensation, $1,000 million. He's got over 100 people who are making over $1 million a year, taking over $1,000 million. His predecessor, Bill McGuire, Dollar Bill McGuire, had taken over $1.5 billion out of UnitedHealthcare, and UnitedHealthcare is the main company that provides these Medicare Advantage programs. So Obamacare says, we're going to dial back on the Medicare Advantage programs. We're not going to give so much money to these big private corporations that are showing such huge profits that Stephen Hemsley can make over $1 billion. We're going to dial back on that, and people are running around with their hair on fire saying, oh, my God, he's cutting Medicare. No, he's cutting Medicare Advantage. And it's not even that he's cutting it. These companies are still going to be profitable. They're just not going to be as profitable.
Exactly. And then I'll have one other point, Tom. I don't want to take too much time here. But the other big provider, as you know, of Advantage plans is AARP.
Well, AARP provides UnitedHealthcare's plans. They're just the front guys. They're just the salespeople. So it's actually UnitedHealthcare when you're talking about AARP.
Yes. Yeah, that's true, but what I'm saying is that AARP has been notoriously silent on this whole Social Security, Medicare.
Well, that's because they're making a fortune. You know, I mean, if UnitedHealthcare is able to pay their CEO $1 billion, I'm guessing the head of the AARP is making pretty good money, too.
Exactly, but at any rate, I've appreciated your clear-minded, advocacy on this, and just keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you, Kurt. I appreciate the call. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Hack, it says you disagree with me?
Well, I don't understand. Betsy McCoy is an expert on health care. I've read her book, and you turn it into some sort of political discussion.
Well, this thing started politically. All legislation is the consequence of politics.
Well, did she come on the show to fight about Republicans and Democrats? No,
I did not make it partisan.
Yes, you did.
Okay, well,
Republicans.
All right, well, okay. To the extent that Republicans universally oppose Obamacare and Democrats promote it, I was asking, what is the motivation of Democrats? I know what the motivation of Democrats was when they passed Social Security. It was twofold. Number one, they wanted to cut, and they did, by a third, the number of old people who were dying of diseases related to hypothermia and malnutrition. I know, but number two, the second motivation that they had is they wanted to win elections. They wanted to do what was popular. That's why Democrats voted for unemployment insurance. That's why Democrats voted for Medicare. It's why Democrats voted for Medicaid. It's why Democrats, by and large, vote for programs that give government benefits, take money from rich people and give government benefits to poor people and working class people. By and large, Democrats do it because it gets them elected. And I understand why Republicans oppose those things, because they, by and large, are funded by the rich people. I understand all that. What I don't understand is if what Betsy is saying is true, and the death panel stuff that she was running around saying 2 years ago has been largely completely disproven. So she's not number one on the credibility list for me, although she's not here to defend herself, so I don't want to go beyond that. But if what she says is true, I don't understand why Democrats would promote a piece of legislation that they say, here, just like with Medicare and Social Security, we're going to do something for the average person, the working person, the poor person, but not actually do it. Actually do it in a way that screws older people who overwhelmingly show up to vote, and a large percentage of them vote for Democrats. I don't get it. Ack, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I don't think that Betsy has an explanation for this. I mean, her two explanations were they didn't think we'd figure it out, and I forget the other one, something like that, some variation. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. By the way, this week we are, or not by the way, hey, it's pretty important. This week we are raising funds. We're trying to put new roofs on four buildings at the Hunter School up in New Hampshire, and put a new kitchen in Mountain Home, one of the houses there, and just generally support the program. Although this is all specifically, all of your contributions are going to go directly to helping physically build this, you know, repair. Actually, the place has been there for 30 plus years. The Hunter School and the New England Salem Children's Village. The telephone number, the website is hunterschool.org. The telephone number is 800-897-8358. And your contributions would be, or are, very much appreciated. If you're looking for a good charity to help out here at the end of the year or toward the end of the year, it'll be November at the end of this week. If you're looking for a good charity to help out this year, 800-897-8358 is Hunter School and the Salem Children's Village, New England Salem Children's Village. And I have personal knowledge of this because my wife Louise and I started this program in 1978. We started in a little house in Merrimack, New Hampshire with three foster kids and our kids, and then we moved up to Rumney and bought a larger property and hired staff and built this program. Initially with some funds that we had from a business that we had sold. We lived off that for about 5 years. And then we went back into the business world because we were out of money. And turned the program over to some very, very responsible and competent professionals. And it's a very, very high quality program now that works with and treats and teaches. It's a residential school, teaches kids who are principally on the autism spectrum, who are severe enough in their behaviors and their problems that they can't function in public schools, but not so severe that they should be institutionalized. And this is just a great environment, no more than 6 to 8 kids in a house, a couple of house parents, a great school. It's small and funky and vegetarian, and it's a great program up in New Hampshire. So, please support them. 800-897-8358. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, you wanted to talk about Dr. Betsy's talking points?
Yes. To begin with, I'm an independent. I'm not siding with Dr. Betsy at all. But having worn the moccasins, I've been a Medicare person. You don't get it till you complete the full 29 months. I got my SSDI in 2003, have not been able to climb the healthcare ladder because basically I can't find doctors willing to accept Medicare. Mm-hmm. And that's what you read in the fine print if you actually read the United Healthcare thing under high def. You can see it clearly. It says you just have to find a doctor who accepts Medicare assignment.
So you're talking about Medicare Advantage, not Medicare.
No, any of the Medicare programs. It has to be...
Right, but the Medicare itself is a government program. The Medicare programs, in plural, are all private health insurance companies who are filling holes that over the years, principally since the Reagan administration, have been drilled into the original Medicare program. The original Medicare program, you didn't have to buy anything from anybody. You just showed up at the doctor, got treated.
Medicare's not my primary. I have primary insurance. Medicare is the secondary.
I see.
And because I cannot coordinate the benefits, I mean, this is so bad that the great one, Bernie Sanders, despite being on part of the health committee, is not going to be able to put the Humpty Dumpty health care back together.
Yeah. And are you over 65, Susan?
They're going to stay out because it doesn't meet the requirements. That's his new tech, is if it doesn't meet the ACA requirements, we'll just have to eliminate that kind of health care.
Well, there is a lot of junk insurance. There are a lot of junk insurance plans out there, particularly that have been sold in the last 2 years. There's been a frenzy of selling these $50 a month plans, these $80 a month plans, that basically are nothing. They you know, if you get sick or you get in trouble, you're going to discover that you got nothing. But I doubt that's what you're talking about. It sounds to me like what you're talking about are Medicare supplementals. Are you over 65?
No, I'm disabled. And see, this is what's bad. It's
Okay.
The elderly, it's targeting the disabled, the challenged children that might be disabled. And to me, like you already said, you'd have to go within a class suit. You're never going to see your day in court.
Right.
The death penalty occurs because...
I didn't know that Medicare covered people who were under 65. Does it?
Yes. You have to wait the full 29 months unless you have Lou Gehrig's ALF.
Right. Unless you're over 65. Okay, so you're in this kind of special category that that I frankly can't speak to. I'll take your word for everything you said. I don't know any of the details of that.
130 pounds, a distance runner. I cannot keep weight on myself. I'm down to anywhere from 82 to 86 pounds.
Ouch. Yeah. I think if anything, Susan, your story is a strong argument for our simply leapfrogging over Medicare, Medicaid, social, you know, all of it, Obamacare, and going directly to a single payer healthcare system where everybody in the country, like what I experienced when I lived in Germany, where you just literally, you walk into the doctor's office, you don't even need an appointment, and you say, I'm here, and they say, great, the doctor will see you shortly. Walk into a hospital and say, hey, I think I'm having a heart attack, which I did. And they said, you know, within minutes, I was inside a CAT scan machine or whatever kind of machine it was, you know, checking me out. And nobody ever asked for anything other than this little 9-digit number that was the equivalent of my Social Security number, the German equivalent of that. And that's it. I mean, they literally did not even have an office where you could pay a bill in the hospital. There was no office where you could pay a bill and no person who could take your money in the doctor's offices in Germany when we lived there in the 80s. And that's how single payer healthcare works, and that's and it's complete and comprehensive. It covered the local herbalist that Louise went to. It covered the local homeopath. I believe it covered the local chiropractor. Their old age program and retirement program covered spas. You know, where people would go for up to I think it was up to 2 weeks a year. You could go to these places out in the mountains. You know, where you go hiking and climbing and taking saunas and stuff. And It was a really extraordinary program, and we really need to do that. Anyhow, Susan, thank you for the call, and thank you for making the point you did. Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Well, you're right on point. I mean, I was just listening to you on my phone here, but, you know, healthcare is a social responsibility. I think we all have to realize that. I think we all have to realize that everybody's a human being. We're all going to get sick at some point. We're all going to need medical care. And unfortunately, if you get sick and really sick, you're not going to be able to work, so you're not going to be able to pay a premium.
Right.
I think that's really important that we change this argument that seems to be, you know, the mainstream today about fighting over this and come to an agreement that we want to pay, want everybody to pay for this system that they're all going to use. We're doing it now. We're just not getting their participation, those being the uninsured and those being the people that feel that they don't have to pay for future needs today.
Right.
And, you know, the getting the young people to appreciate that, you know, there's a responsibility that we all have to take. I mean, you sign up for the Selective Service or you get insurance for your car. You need to look at it like they do in Europe, where you take responsibility for the injury that you might cause somebody else before you go skiing or something like that. But I wanted to say that we need to change the argument since we're already talking about this. The people that don't pay for health care insurance through their employer are probably ahead of the game because we've tied the wages of the working class people to the amount of money that we the employer pays for insurance. When I was employed, my employer would pay $1,800 a month, and they'd say, well, we can't afford pay raises because health care keeps going up.
Right.
And wages have stagnated under this false pressure of trying to pay, as you suggest, the top end of the CEOs, these exorbitant salaries. And in the meantime, the working class person is getting the short end of the stick.
Yeah, and I think it would be a really, really good and healthy thing to disentangle health insurance from employment because, A, a lot of people are unemployed or they have jobs that they would really rather not have, and in many cases they're keeping those jobs simply because their health insurance is tied to it. And if health insurance was completely independent of employment, then you're covered whether you have a job or not, whether it's a great job or a lousy job, whether you hate the job or you love the job. And if you decide to quit the job and go off and start your own business or, you know, just start something from scratch, the way that Louise and I started this radio show, you know, when we did this, we had to buy health insurance through the local Chamber of Commerce in Montpelier, Vermont. And, you know, frankly, it shouldn't be that way. You know, somebody who couldn't have afforded to pay for health care for the first 2.5 years that we did this show, there was no income. They wouldn't have been able to do that, you know, and so it's like we're stifling entrepreneurialism as well. Excellent point, Joe. Thank you for the call. Scott, in Garberville, California, you have a comment on the marijuana initiative in California. We have a minute to the break.
I just wanted to say that right now people can go to the website www.cchi2014 for the petition that has been accepted by the Secretary of State of California to legalize cannabis in all its forms.
Okay, CCHI 2014, 2014 as in next year, CCHI as in California what?
Cannabis Health Initiative 2014.
Great. California Cannabis Health Initiative, CCHI2014.what?
ORG.
.org. Okay, great. Scott, thank you very much. And hopefully a whole bunch of people will go there. I appreciate the call. CCHI2014.org is the website to decriminalize cannabis in California. Their experience with medical marijuana, by the way, great piece about it in today's, I think it was the New York Times, has been very, very favorable. So we'll be back 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, if the Fox News talking points are right, what would have been the motivation for President Obama and the Democrats to try to screw old people and everybody else? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sarah in Hemet, California. Hey, Sarah, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, first of all, I'd like to begin the conversation by telling you that I am a backer of Obamacare. I always have been. In fact, I would have preferred, Medicare for all, yeah. But I am definitely a backer of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
But I am on Medicare now, Medicare Advantage through Kaiser Permanente.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a letter in the mail a few weeks ago saying that the out-of-pocket expenses for Medicare Advantage were going to go from $3,400 a year to $5,900 a
right.
year.
Now, let's keep in mind, Medicare Advantage has virtually nothing to do with Medicare. It's not a government program.
Okay.
It's a private for-profit program.
I called Kaiser. Yeah, but wait a minute. I called Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah.
Okay? And I said to them, what's going on here? Why is this going up so drastically? And they said they had nothing to do with it. They said that was a directive from Medicare.
No,
Medicare,
they lied to you.
Set that amount. That's what they told me. Okay,
yeah.
Maybe they were lying to me. So I just wanted, you know, or misleading me or whatever, but
yeah.
I just feel that in this discussion, we need to be, you know, armed with the facts and, you know, for whatever reason, you may be correct in that, but I'd like to, you know, find...
You might want to call a couple of the other Medicare Advantage companies, you know, call United Healthcare, as much as I dislike them. Give them a call and just say, hey, I'm on Kaiser Permanente Medicare Advantage program, and my deductible just went up to $5,900. What's your deductible? What's it going up to? And,
yeah.
You know, just fact check it yourself.
You know...
There's a couple of companies
entirely,
that...
It is entirely possible that they're passing the buck to Medicare when it really wasn't Medicare.
Well, of course they would.
I hate to think that Kaiser would do that, but I will investigate this further, but I just wanted you to know...
Well, report back to us, okay? Let us know what you find out.
Yeah, I will do that.
If they've all gone to $5,900, then maybe there is something to it. But, you know, from my conversations with Wendell Potter a couple of weeks ago, he came on this program and answered a whole lot of questions, and he really knows his stuff well. And he actually is a healthcare expert. He used to work for Aetna. He used to be a senior vice president of Aetna and knows the industry. And he was pretty strongly asserting that, you know, Medicare is not going to change. Medicare Advantage is not Medicare. It's a, you know, it's a private health insurance plan that fills in the holes that have been drilled into Medicare by various Republican administrations over the years. But that's not going to change. I'm not the expert, so I can't assert that. So if you find something that contradicts that, can you let us know? Or the supports it?
Yes, I'll do that. And
okay.
Again, I'm hoping that, I'm pretty sure that Obamacare is going to be successful, although Medicare for All would have been, in my opinion, much more successful.
I agree. With no Medicare Advantage attached to it, let's just fill in all the holes and take the health insurance industry out of the equation altogether. They're just bankers. You know, they're just passing money through. They don't check any little kids' throats. They don't give anybody a vaccine. They don't do surgery. They're just money changers. And I don't understand why they're part of our healthcare system. Sarah, thank you for the call. In other countries, you know, they don't have them, or they only have them for very rich people who want to stay in exclusive, you know, very fancy, just rich people kind of hospitals. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, and Lori is on line 11, right?
Yeah, great.
Lori Ferris is with us. She is the program director at the Hunter School and the New England Salem Children's Village. And as I told you earlier in the hour, we are doing a fundraiser this week for Hunter School. The number is 800-897-8358. Lori, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. So tell us, first of all, what Hunter School and Salem Children's Village, what y'all are up to?
Okay. Well, the Hunter School, it's a nonprofit residential and day school. It's a therapeutic school nestled up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, where young children, kindergarten through eighth grade, that have been diagnosed with disorders such as ADHD, anxiety, autism, mood disorders, etc., are nurtured, educated, and really celebrated here in our program. Mm.
Tell me about the energy program.
The energy program is a really interesting component. We have a component that's called energetic mindfulness, and what we found has been really successful and worked really well with our children is teaching these children about energies, about thoughts, and about consciousness, and teaching them that they can empower positive thoughts in their brains, or they can empower negative thoughts, and that there are consequences from either. And we use mindfulness, we use meditation, we have classes that we teach 3 days a week, and we also work very closely with families to help families shift and have a more positive outlook on their children and the challenges that they're encountering.
And what kind of results are you getting?
We are getting fantastic results. What's really neat is that the program is an integrative program, so we have all the mainstream modalities, psychiatrist, OT, etc., but we're all coming from that energetic mindfulness perspective. And what we're finding is that it's very, very simple. Kids really get it. It's easy to apply, and we're able to affect some really positive change pretty quickly, considering the challenges that these children have.
Great. The number is 800-897-8358. The fundraiser that we're doing this year is for very specific stuff. You want to tell us about what it is that this nonprofit needs?
Absolutely. We really need help with the infrastructure. There's a lot of maintenance and upkeep to our buildings, roofs, furniture. We're really out in the country. Generators would be extremely helpful. We also, you know, enrichment programs for these children are really, really important, being able to do educational field trips, scholarships, etc. We're grateful for all of the support, and particularly appreciate all the support from your viewers over the years, because it really has made a huge difference in supporting our ability to help these kids.
This is the Hunter School. The number is 800-897-8358, and that's Hunter as in Hunter to Farmer's World, my original conception of ADHD that I came up with back in the, well, actually out of the result of starting this program, which originally was called the New England Salem Children's Village. that Louise and I started back in 1978 in Merrimack, and then moved up in 79 to Romney. And so we're looking for a new roof for Mountain House, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and generators, because you're 3 miles out on a dirt road on the backside of the mountain on one side and a 2,000-acre lake on the other side. It's beautiful country.
Absolutely, and we're very isolated, and we're off the grid, and we do get power outages here relatively frequently, particularly in the winter, and it's challenging if it lasts more than a few hours to be able to properly service the school and the houses.
Right.
So.
You're on the grid, but you lose the grid a lot.
Correct.
Whatever, you get a good winter storm.
At times it feels as though we're off the grid because I'm looking out the window, and it's absolutely beautiful with the mountains, and
yeah.
Can't see any power lines, et cetera, but that's true.
Yeah. Do you welcome visitors up there? If anybody is listening to us right now and they say, wow, that sounds really cool and I'd like to learn more about it.
Absolutely. We'd love to have visitors. And all anyone has to do is just call and make an appointment. But I like nothing more than to take people through the campus and get to meet some of the kids and, you know, the amazing staff and really see the incredible work that everyone's doing up here. It's a real labor of love, but it's so worthwhile.
Yeah, it absolutely is a labor of love. The toll-free number for donations is 800-897-8358, 800-897-8358. And if you'd like to learn more about it, there's two websites, hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org, that talk about the two different sides of the program. Principally, it's Hunter School nowadays. And we're doing this fundraiser right now. What I understand that Lisa Ling was just up there from the Oprah show.
She actually has her own show. It's Our America on the Oprah Network. And she and a small television crew from New York were recently on campus for 2 days filming a documentary about ADHD, pharmaceutical drugs, and alternative ways of helping these children, such as what we utilize at the Hunter School.
And what came out of that?
It was fantastic. The kids, everybody were incredibly welcoming. She was so articulate, so sensitive to the issues. A lot of these kids have, they don't just have ADHD. They have other behavioral issues, and it was an absolute, amazing experience to have the crew and Lisa really integrate in our day-to-day routine. And they did follow one student in particular, his story from Vermont and where this child had originally come into the school on lots of pharmaceuticals and lots of anger and issues and where this boy is today, which is he's doing incredible. So it was very, very heartfelt, and it was really a great experience.
Yeah, this is a program that has been saving kids' lives and changing kids' lives for 30 some odd years, since 1978, and they need your help right now. And so if it's the end of the year here, more or less, and if you think you have a little left in the pot to give to a good charity, Hunter School is a good charity, and the toll-free number to make a donation, with your credit card or however you'd like to do it, they can give you an address, you can mail a check, is 800-897-8358. Or you can donate through the website at hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org as well. There you can donate by credit card or PayPal. And do you have a sense of what the total is that we need to, that we would be a good goal for us to raise in this fundraising drive?
I think it would be wonderful if we set a goal of $10,000. It would go a long ways to making a huge difference, but everything helps.
Oh, I think we should do more than that.
You want to do more than that?
Couple of roofs. I'd think 30 or 40. But,
okay.
Keep us up to date on how we're doing, and I'll keep our listeners apprised. We should be able to do that. I really think we should be able to do that.
I will do that. And thank you so much, Tom, and thank you so much to all the listeners.
Thank you so much, Lori. Lori Ferris, the program director at Hunter School. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very, very interesting policy debate going on right now in Washington, D.C., or in some states, actually, I think, as well. The country's Highway Trust Fund, which is principally paid for with money that, you know, the gas tax, is running low. And the reason it's running low is because when it was put into place way back in the day, it was set at a specific amount rather than as a percentage of the cost of gas. So as the price of gas has gone up, the gas tax hasn't gone up. And on top of that, and you've got an entire Republican Party that refuses to vote for tax increases, and most Democrats don't want to either. I mean, who wants to be the guy who raised the cost of gas, or the girl? And number one. And number two, that cars are getting more efficient. Cars are using less gasoline. And so as cars use less gasoline, there's less money in gas taxes. So, you know, the gas companies make up for that by raising prices. They sell less gas, but they make more money. But in terms of tax revenue that maintains highways, it ain't there. So one of the brilliant solutions that has been proposed that gets lawmakers out of having to say, gee, let's raise gas taxes, or let's even peg them to the cost of gasoline. So as gas goes up, gas taxes go up. One of the solutions that they've come up with is, let's put a little black box in your car that detects how many miles you drive every month and then just basically sends you a bill for the damage you're causing to the highway. And some people say, well, this could be calibrated so that your 6,000-pound SUV pays a higher tax rate than your 2,000-pound Toyota Prius. And others are saying, oh, no, it should be the same for everybody, mostly people who own 6,000-pound SUVs. And Adrian Moore, and this is bringing about an interesting coalition from the Tea Party and the libertarians like Adrian to progressives like me. He's the vice president of the Policy Reason Foundation, co-author of Mobility First, A New Vision of Transportation in a Globally Competitive 21st Century, the website for the Reason Foundation, of course, reason.org. Adrian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be on.
Thank you. Did I summarize this situation well, or would you like to add something or even refute or dispute anything I just said?
It's a pretty good summary. I would tweak a couple of things. One was just something that you didn't mention. Most people don't know that there is a federal gas tax that is pays for about a third of all of transportation spending, and the rest of it comes from state and local taxes, mostly state gas taxes. The average person pays, give or take, $180 a year in gasoline taxes, so it's not remotely the biggest tax we pay. And, yeah, what's been happening is we're all driving more or as much as we ever did in most cases, but because our vehicles are getting more fuel efficient, we're paying less, but the roads aren't getting any cheaper to provide. And so the idea of charging by the mile has come about. Now, the idea of doing it with a black box has never been popular with anybody. Nobody wants to be tracked to speak of. And so the states that have experimented with this have not done black boxes. What they've done is given people a choice of a range of technologies, starting with really low-tech stuff like just having your odometer read where there's no data really to speak of.
Right, and you would do that presumably every year when you do your safety inspection to get your sticker.
Do your safety inspection or your smog inspection if you're in one of those places or whatever it is.
Right.
You might have something where your onboard computer on your car can actually be, with just a little add-on chip, basically keep track of how many miles you drive and can then broadcast just that number to, say, the gasoline pump or whatever you want to set it up as, but it can just say, this guy drove this many miles and owes this much this month.
Right.
So you could pay more often that way. And that way the data only lives in your car. It doesn't get broadcast anymore. And then there's the more intrusive GPS style idea or cellular idea where your car actually kind of is tracked. But
Right.
That's not a very popular.
And there's two other things we haven't mentioned. One is that people who drive electric cars like the Nissan Leaf or mostly electric cars like the Chevy Volt may end up paying no gas taxes at all, yet they're still using the roads.
Exactly.
And what's fair about that? This seems like there's a problem there. And the second is that one of the major ways that a lot of municipalities and states recover the cost of highway maintenance is with tolls.
Right. I mean, tolling is a small percentage. It's less than 10% of all of the revenue.
Right.
But it has been increasingly important for building new roads. More new roads that have been built in the last 10 years have been tolled than any time in
right.
history. So there is some tolling out there, but the big gaps here really are, it's really urban areas. You know, we're not missing major interstates across the country. We're not missing major links between states in most cases. Mostly what we have are problems funding urban area transportation. But I'm talking urban areas all the way down to like 100, 150,000, not necessarily just huge cities. And being able to have a sustainable mechanism where the money isn't declining year after year is important. But on the other hand, we've got to get better at using the money we've already got. I mean, nobody wants to increase gas taxes because nobody wants to be the guy or the girl that increases taxes. But like everywhere else, one of the things we should be doing before we even talk about raising taxes is figure out, is all the money being used as well as it could be?
I'll tell you, Adrian, you know, Louise and I moved here.
The most efficient agency in government.
Yeah, Louise and I moved here to D.C. 3 years ago. And for the first time since I was 16 years old, I don't have a car. We sold our Honda Prius or Toyota Prius, I guess it is, when we left Portland. And I use the Metro almost exclusively. Occasionally, if I've got to go someplace Metro just can't get to, I will either take a cab or I'll take Uber. But, you know, the Metro in this town is incredible. And when I'm in New York City, I always use the subway. You know, I forget what they call the transit system in New York City. And is that also the Metro?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, why don't we, and I've used the train in Boston as well. It's not as good. It's not as complete as DC or New York, but it's pretty good. And L.A. used to have, I mean, back before the conspiracy, you know, between General Motors and what was it, Firestone, I think it was, you know, they offered to fix all, to run all the public transportation systems, and they ripped up all the rails. Los Angeles used to have the best public transportation system in the country in the 1920s. But it's like, isn't that, you know, probably the best solution is get people out of single-person cars. It seems silly to move 6,000 pounds of steel around to get, you know, 35 blocks.
Right. Well, we've never – that's what we've been trying to do for 30 years, and we're kind of spinning our wheels, if I can make a pun, on that.
But we haven't been. I mean, there's been no significant funding.
For 20 years now, in our major metro areas of the United States, somewhere between 25 and 50%, depending on the metro area, of all transportation spending in those cities for two decades has been on public transit, and the percentage of people who ride transit in all of those cities is flat.
Right.
So even spending 30, 40% of the money, say in Los Angeles, we've spent around 35% of all the money for two decades on public transit. And
well, they've been building that out like crazy in L.A. I mean, that's been very expensive.
80% of the people are using it. Now, in D.C., you're talking about 7, 8% of the people using transit. It's a more significant percentage, but still, it's 7 or 8%.
Right. So what's the libertarian solution? We're just about out of time here.
Well, I mean, I think smart transit is part of every urban area. And, you know, the most cost-effective investments in transit are crucial. But most people still choose to travel by cars, and fortunately, cars are getting cleaner and more efficient. So
right.
we just need to provide that infrastructure, and people need to pay for it directly.
Right.
I like mileage-based fees because it's like it's a user fee. It's direct. People know what they pay and know what they get.
Right.
Whereas with the gas tax right now, nobody knows what they pay, and they don't really know where the money's going.
Yeah. The advantage of a gas tax is that it discourages the use of carbon. But the disadvantage, as I pointed out earlier, is that electric cars are using the roads, but they're not helping to pay for their maintenance. So I think maybe a hybrid of the two. Anyhow, it's an interesting conversation. Adrian Moore, thanks for dropping by, Doc.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
AdrianMooreReason.org is the website. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Tim in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Oh, Tom, come on home.
Yeah, I love Michigan. I get back there every summer to visit my family.
That's good. Well, we got our governor, you know that.
Yeah.
And
he's kind of one of the things that keeps me away.
Yeah, I'd like to leave myself. But we got the worst roads and the worst drivers in the United States.
You've never been to Boston.
Well, his idea and on the ballot coming up is to tax the homeowners to fix the roads.
That's interesting.
At like $44, and I don't know if that's per 100,000 for your home or if that's $44 flat. I don't know.
Right.
But that's his idea of raising revenue to fix the roads. Now, I have a good friend that worked for the state, and he was a bridge inspector. And he says the worst destruction of roads comes from the people that are fixing the roads. We have a company here that, well, I won't name them, but they transport when they're fixing the roads. They cause more destruction on the roads, fixing the roads, than a car.
Because they're hauling around big heavy machinery, you mean?
That's right. That's right. And I think those companies ought to be taxed the heaviest of anybody. I don't think a homeowner... Our taxes are become ridiculous in this Grand Rapids area.
Yeah.
And the state of Michigan. And to tax us to fix the roads, we're already paying 33 cents a gallon for a tax on our gas.
Right.
To go and then add another tax on just because you own a home is completely wrong. But this is his nerdy way because he believes a nerd should run a nerdy state. Because he's already started his, propaganda.
Yeah, somehow his "I am a nerd." It's like softening. He's not a nerd. He's a right wing hack, and in any case, well, if you're going to do that, it seems like the more remote you live, like the people out in Holt should pay probably a higher tax per thousand than the people in downtown Lansing because they're more like, or the farther you are away from a city center to which one could presumably walk, or the farther away you are from a bus line, which most people could easily use, the higher the tax, and the closer you are to a bus line, or the higher closer you are, because that's the only public transportation in Central Michigan and Lansing. Unless you guys built a subway system while I was gone, I don't think that happened. The closer you live to a bus line, the lower the tax to encourage people to use the buses.
Right now we're being taxed to build a bus line from one end of the Grand Rapids area to the north end to the south end. We had that tax passed and it's being built now, and so we're already been taxed and it's being put into process right now.
Now is that on rail? Is that a above ground light rails line or is this just buses?
Them are just buses and it's going to have their own special lane.
Oh, I see. Very interesting. But if somebody's living in Lowell, I mean, they're going to be driving a whole lot more than somebody living in Grand Rapids. Maybe they should be paying more. I don't know. I don't have an easy solution for it, Tim. I'm not sure anybody does. But thanks for the call. It is a thought-provoking conversation. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past me. Wines have some of the highest pesticide levels in our food chain. EcoWine.com, the organic wine company, has pesticide-free wines. That's EcoWine.com. Okay, so, how do we pay for, our roads? Well, that's one good question. Here's another one. How do you motivate your kids? This is literally one of the very few things that Louise and I debated as parents throughout our kids growing up, and we always ended up going. Louise and I kind of compartmentalized our lives. You have to have in advance of an argument a decision about who's going to win the argument. I believe if you're going to have a relationship, it's going to last over the long haul. So because we run businesses together, anything that has to do with creative content, I have final say on this show. And, you know, if she has an idea and I don't like it, it doesn't make it on the air. If I have an idea and she doesn't like it, I can push it through. Now, she can talk me out of it or into it and vice versa. You know, you make your best argument, but creative content, I have final say. If it has to do with money, though, she has final say. Anything to do with cash. I haven't looked at a checkbook in three or four years, so I'm clueless about the money. Well, similarly with our kids, raising our kids, we had deals with our kids, about who has the final say, and the big issues of child rearing, Louise had final say on, and she disagreed with this, bribing your kids. I thought it was a good idea. And I always thought that, you know, we should say, you know, if you get an A, or if you get all A's, you get an extra $100 quarterly or something like that, or you get, you know, you can work for something. And Louise was always of the opinion that, no, there should be, I'm probably characterizing her poorly, so I don't want to do this too much. But basically that success should be its own reward. And that kids need to find intrinsic motivation rather than extrinsic motivation. That by bribing your kids, you are constantly teaching them that they should only do something if somebody else gives them something. And that they need to learn how to do things because they find value in it themselves. And they discover the joy of accomplishment. And I think that, you know, that's how I was raised, by the way that Louise suggested. My parents never paid me anything to do anything. I got an allowance every week, which was fairly, 50 cents a dollar, something like that, when I was young. And there were certain jobs associated with that, taking out the trash and mowing the lawn. But it wasn't an absolute quid pro quo. And we did have allowances for our kids, and there were jobs that they had to do. But Newt Gingrich was on our program last week, and he suggested that the solution to the problem of our schools is just plain old simple, flat out, let's just bribe our kids. Here's what Newt said on our program.
I think that we should maximize learning at the earliest possible age, and we should even be prepared to pay for it. I used to do a program called Earning by Learning, and in the summertime, I would pay children in public housing $2 a book for every book they read. You would be astonished how many poor children are actually willing to earn money at an early age. If you tie and who are willing to sit down and read books. And we had one young girl in Villarica, Georgia at 9 years of age who read 83 books that summer. Now, she would never have had $166 any other way. And it gave her a sense of connecting achievement with reward in a way that frankly got her in trouble when she went back to school, because she could read too well, and she was no longer in the regular curriculum.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, Newt's schemes always end up with such incredible good results that it's like, wow, you know, it's overwhelming. But I say that facetiously, but I've over the years come more and more to the opinion that that's a bad idea. But I have a hard time rebutting the response, which is, well, that's how it works for adults. You show up for work, you get a paycheck. And if you prepare yourself with a certain skill set, you get a better paycheck than if you have no skill set at all. And to a certain extent, some of those things are within your choice. And so that's how the world works. Why don't we introduce kids to that at an early age and get them competent at that? And I have not been able to rebut that other than, I would say, Louise's response, which was kids should be kids. You know, they should have a childhood where they're not thinking, okay, you know, is this what, you know, what do I have to do to earn something, to make something? You know, it's like, you know, is that, and in fact, could it be that, you know, giving, you know, a reward-based system just raises a whole generation of little Koch brothers? You know, where everything is monetized, everything has a price, the world is no longer alive and magical, friendships don't matter unless there's money associated with them. And that's my concern about bribing kids and raising kids that way. And it's interesting because over the New York Times today, their Room for Debate column is about this. Should you bribe your kids? And they got one person who says, no, it's a bad idea. Another person says, I'm an unabashed briber of my children. Another one says, let's see, how much is it worth for you to know? Yep, that's pretty much the reason I reject this approach. That's Brian Feeler, I think, or Feller. KJ says it offers me a position of power as a parent. Parents are quick to fear bribes. You don't bribe for the small stuff, but you do for the big stuff. And then Bruce says, well, but what happens when the bribee sets the price? And the kids say, no, I'm not going to do it for that. I want more. And now you're suddenly in this negotiation. And, you know, presumably there are some times when this might work and sometimes when it won't. But the one area where when we were raising our kids where we explicitly did this and didn't tell them was we knew from our experience running the Salem Children's Village that the biggest experience, the biggest influencer of a child when they're growing up is not their parents, it's their peers. And you can't say, I'll give you $5 if you'll hang out with Johnny. But what we did do is the kids that we really didn't want our kids to hang out with, we would never volunteer to take them to the movies together or, you know, take them to the mall together or whatever. And the kids that we did want our kids to hang out with, we went out of our way to make it really easy for that to happen. We were suddenly always available to offer a ride or, you know, you can invite them over tonight. Oh, that other person, Thursday, we're busy. You know, my kids are probably hearing this on the radio for the first time. We never told our kids that we were doing this, but I think it worked out pretty well. But is that bribery? I don't know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So Medicare, and by the way, I got to tell you something about Medicare that I just learned, and bribing your kids, and how do we pay for our roads? And there's a lot to talk about today. We'll be right back with more of that. The bad and the very, very exiguously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good. Robert Greenwald, the filmmaker's new documentary, Unmanned, America's Drone Wars, takes a hard and uncompromising look at our country's ongoing drone campaign and gives drone strike victims a chance to tell their stories. The American people deserve to know the truth about what the government does in their name, in our names. And Robert Greenwald should be commended for helping us learn more about the horror of the drone wars. By the way, you know the family featured in Greenwald's documentary? They spoke today at a congressional briefing held by Florida Representative Alan Grayson. Talk about bravery. The bad. The bigoted New York bus driver. An unnamed New York City bus driver has been sued by a Brooklyn family for allegedly kicking the family's son off the bus for being a Muslim. According to the family's lawyer, the boy began to pray in Arabic after he lost his bus pass. The driver freaked out when he heard the boy praying and closed the bus doors in his face, calling him a terrorist. It's really no excuse to talk to anyone like that, let alone a 10-year-old boy. And the very, very ugly Jim Wheeler. The Nevada State Assemblyman is under fire today after a YouTube video surfaced of him telling an audience of Republican activists that he would vote for slavery if that's what his constituents wanted. Really, seriously, check it out.
I will do what my constituents want, end of discussion. And Chuck moved through other things saying, well, I guess this guy, he didn't know me at all. And he says, I guess this guy, if the citizens of District 39 want to bring slavery back, come on for slavery. So I wrote him a letter back and I said, if that's what they want.
Wheeler has since tried to apologize by saying he just wanted to show how committed he is to representing his district. But there's really no excuse for that. It was very, very ugly. That's bizarre. That's downright bizarre. So Congress, Democrats put forward a proposal in Congress to de-weaponize the debt ceiling, to basically say that you can't use it to hold the president hostage anymore. And Mitch McConnell says, this is outrageous. And that's the word he used. Outrageous. Really? So you plan on holding some more hostages, huh, Mitch? Another couple of months? Boy, it's going to get entertaining. Okay, Medicare. I mentioned I was going to explain something about this. Again, I in fact, probably we should get Wendell Potter on to explain this stuff. But from what I'm learning, and I'm not old enough to qualify for Medicare, so I haven't gone through the learning curve myself. But my understanding is that when you turn 65 and you qualify for Medicare, you can either have Medicare provide your health care just good old-fashioned government Medicare, or you can buy one of these Medicare Advantage plans. Now, there's also Medigap, okay? So if you have just good old-fashioned Medicare, you can also buy Medigap coverage, and what it does is it fills in the holes in Medicare. But the way that Medicare Advantage works, which I misunderstood, and Shane pointed me to Medicare.gov, and I printed out a bunch of pages from this, and it basically, you know, lays it all out. And I encourage you to go to Medicare.gov. You can read the whole thing. Basically, what happens is if you sign up for one of these Medicare Advantage plans, you're no longer getting health insurance from Medicare. The health insurance company becomes a contractor on your behalf that goes out and provides you with services and then bills Medicare for those things, plus it bills you. And they compete in different areas and all that kind of thing. And so it may well be that those of you who have Medicare Advantage are going to see a price increase. I don't know. I mean, it's possible because there it is true that Obamacare is going to dial back the subsidies because the Medicare Advantage, part of it's paid for by you, part of it's paid for by Medicare, and part of it is just plain old subsidized by the government. Right? This is another, you know, trough for the big health insurance companies. Another way that they just pigs at the trough. And what the Obama administration is doing is saying, we're going to cut back on the money that we're just giving these insurance companies so that Stephen Hemsley can take a $1 billion paycheck. And so they may be saying, okay, we're going to take it out of the hide of our recipients. So you might want to consider, you know, look at, and again, I need to learn more about this, and we'll get Wendell Potter on to talk about it. But the time may come in the next year or two or three where it makes more sense to have just good old-fashioned Medicare with a Medigap plan to fill in the blanks rather than having Medicare Advantage and just not even bother with Medicare Advantage. But don't take that as advice. Just take that as a starting point for a conversation with the people at Medicare.gov and if you have an insurance agent or whatever. And perhaps I'm guessing some of you know a whole lot more about this than I do, and you may want to inform me on this. So should you bribe your kids? How do we pay for our highways? What are we going to do about Obamacare? And the big question that Betsy couldn't really answer for me is what evil lurks in the heart of President Obama that he would want to stick it to old people in order to have Obamacare? Now, it looks to me like he's not sticking it to old people. It looks to me like he's sticking it to the health insurance companies who are offering Medicare Advantage. And that Medicare is still there and is unchanged. In fact, there is a provision in Obamacare, in the law, that says explicitly Medicare coverage cannot be reduced. Benefits. The benefits cannot be reduced. So it looks to me like they're taking it out of the hide of UnitedHealthcare and AARP, not out of the height of you and me when I turn 65, you know, should I live that long. But who knows? Tom, in Oak Park, Illinois, you wanted to talk about capital gains and taxes?
Yes, Tom, I have enjoyed your show for a long time. Oh, hang on, I'm taking off speakerphone there. Sorry about
okay.
that.
That's okay.
I was listening last week. I can't catch your show every day, but I try to whenever I can. Love your program. Thank you. You had somebody on last week who was arguing for the point of view that capital gains tax should remain at least where it is or go even lower. And you were having the discussion, and I think about these things all the time, and I came up with an idea. The next time somebody proposed that to you, you asked them a couple of questions. When you invest in a company, do you earn your investment back? Do you earn those dividends? If they say, yes, I do, then that should be counted as earned income. It should not be unearned income on a tax form.
Right.
Therefore, it should be taxed at the higher rate. If they say that, no, I don't earn my income, it's just an investment. And it's like, okay, if you don't earn it, then why are you discriminatory in the tax code saying that you, who don't earn your income, get taxed at a lower rate than somebody who does earn the income?
Right. Anyway. Or for that matter, if you're not actually earning it, then why shouldn't it just go to a charity?
Right.
I mean, why are you taking it if you didn't earn it? I thought the whole point of capitalism in America was, you know, you get what you earn.
Yeah. And then you also ask them, it's like, okay, if you're getting paid out of the profits of the company, who actually earned those profits for you? You know who did? The people who work for the company.
That's correct.
Granted, there are some stockholders who actually work for the company. They are earning it. But you know who's earning the profits? You know who's earning those dividends for the investor? The people who aren't getting the health care, the people who aren't getting the daycare, the people who are getting the wage freezes, everything like that. They're earning it because they're doing the producing, they're doing the production, they're doing the manufacturing, and they're creating the profits, which then go to you.
Yeah, and to use McDonald's as an example, if every executive at McDonald's tomorrow vanished, for a few days anyway, assuming that some of the executives make decisions like, okay, we're going to buy this many hamburger patties for that store. But for a few days anyway, McDonald's would continue to operate and throw off a profit, you know, until they ran out of stock. And if all the executives who didn't have to do with directly just ordering, you know, inventory vanished, they would continue to make a profit. But if all of the employees, frontline employees, the people flipping burgers and dumping French fries and running the cash registers, if all of them vanish tomorrow at 3 o'clock, starting at 3 o'clock, McDonald's would cease to earn income.
That's right.
And I mean, you know, that's how clear it is, you know, that the people who are making money and if the investors all said, hey, we're taking a hike, we're all going to dump our stock, McDonald's would continue to run just fine. Thank you very much. As long as there's people, you know, frying French fries. And this is true of every business. Excellent point, Tom. Thank you for that. Next time I get into an argument like that, I will ask that question. Are you earning that income? That's a great one. Thank you. John in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, John.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to answer a question and ask you a question. One was how do you encourage children or how do you get children motivated? Encouragement and praise. Two words.
Yeah.
Works.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, the question I have for you is, out of the Affordable Health Care Act, you've had many people have called in over the past month complaining about the implementation of it. Well, we already have a state called Massachusetts that has implemented this very program.
Mm-hmm.
Could you have people from that state come on your show and talk about how they resolve the problems of the different insurance companies that price gouge at the very beginning, and then they address those issues and them signing up for the program in their state, because I believe that would, because basically the Massachusetts program is basically the whole program the United States.
That is Obamacare.
Right now,
yeah, that basically is Obamacare. What we should do is we should get Mitt Romney to come on. You know, he back in 2000 when he was running in the Republican primary, and I was over at CPAC and saw his speech, he was planning on his entire campaign being, or maybe it was 2004, I guess it was 2004, he was planning on his entire campaign when he was running for president as being, I'm the guy who did Romney Care and I'll do it for the country. And then, of course, Obama came along with Obamacare and that kind of blew that up. But excellent point,
John.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But we have had people from Massachusetts call into the program, on the program, and Wendell Potter has a lot of familiarity with Massachusetts. It works just fine there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Yes.
Hey, how you doing?
You are on the air. I'm well.
Okay. Listen, your wife is absolutely 100% right. When you think back to your childhood, the statement that we're little sponges makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to know how things work, what they're made of. You want to take things apart and explore. You want to explore your world from scientific, technical point of view. There's no need to bribe or pay your kids to explore the world. They do it for free, so to speak.
Right.
And if you check Newt Gingrich's math, his idea of an 8 or 9 year old reading 83 books, was it, over the summer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you with me?
Yeah.
83 books over 12 weeks, which is usually the summer recess, that's like 6.91, almost 7 books a week. Now, what kid is going to read seven books a week after week after week?
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen that way. They might read one or two books and go over and devour it several times over the course of several weeks.
Or maybe they were 12-page picture books. I don't know.
Some child who just there for mercenary reasons to satisfy a Republican man's ego.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
And on a similar thing, how how about we piss off Republicans even more and talk about not privatizing automobile insurance? If Obama is correct, and he is, about getting the middleman, the banks, out of education, where we have the government offers go directly to the universities to pay for tuition, and we're eventually going to go to single-payer universal health care where everybody gets health care, not health insurance. It would make sense to me that we should also go pay directly the people who repair cars when they get in an automobile accident.
Well, no, I think that there's a significant difference there, Johnny, and that is that education is part of the commons. Education is something that it's an investment in the infrastructure of our future. Healthcare is part of the commons. Our bodies, you know, right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life is inextricably tied up with health. But having a car is a choice. I haven't had a car for 3 years. Many people don't have cars. There's a lot of people in America who don't have cars. A lot of people who live in cities don't have cars. And that's a choice. So it may be that because of an accident of where you were born or where you grew up or where your job is, you really need a car. But that's still, I would say, is a choice. I don't think that that's the commons. I think the roads are the commons. But the car itself is not part of the commons. That's private property.
Tom.
Yes, sir.
Are you there?
I am.
Okay. I'm hearing what you're saying. It seems at first blush that automobile transportation, private transportation, and the associated mandatory insurance doesn't seem to be an investment like education. Right. But it is an investment in a way because it allows people to get to work, because we have city planning as such that not everybody can walk or take a subway to work.
Well, see, that's where the gas tax comes in, or some kind of, you know, mileage tax or whatever. I agree with you that, you know, transportation is our commons. But there's a variety of ways people can transport themselves. And so we collectively pay for sidewalks so people can walk. We collectively pay for roads. We collectively pay for buses and mass transit and then charge a small fee. And when people want to use the roads, we charge a small fee in the form of gas tax. We don't charge people to walk on the sidewalk, which I think is a good thing. We want to incentivize that. I get your point, Johnny. I think that we're just in a very slightly different place where we draw the lines between what's public and what's private, where the commons begin and end. But I get your point. Thank you for calling and sharing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com for our news for the day. And apparently we have Zach, Luke Vargas, and Zach, I'm sorry?
Zach Badorf
on the line with us in by Skype, right?
Yes, hopefully. Oh. Can you see us?
I don't see you yet, but I hear you just fine. Oh, there you guys are. Okay, cool. Yeah, I see you too. So were you both in the refugee camps in Jordan, the Syrian refugee camps?
Yeah, we spent about a week in Jordan, and as you may recall, I was in Turkey in August as well for about 3 weeks, visiting refugee camps there as well. So for me, it was very interesting to see a comparison of the different refugees in Turkey as well as in Jordan.
So that's Luke speaking, right?
Oh, that's Zach.
Oh, that was Zach. Okay. And so thank you, Zach. So, Luke, what was the difference?
Zach saw both of them, so he'll take that.
Yeah, so, okay. I mean, for me, I think the major difference is that the economic impacts on Turkey are not nearly as strong as they are in Jordan. So Jordan has an economy, a GDP of, I think it was roughly $8 billion, and the GDP of, that's roughly $20 billion, and the GDP of Turkey is $80 billion. And the populations are also massively different. You've got, roughly 80 million people in Turkey, and you've got about 8 million people in Jordan. So this influx of 500,000 Syrian refugees into Jordan has massive economic, social, and political dynamic changes. That was one of the things I noticed. There was a lot more visible discontent amongst the Jordanian population than I noticed in Turkey.
Yeah. I'm curious, I've been hearing that one of the things that is driving the Syrian conflict is a drought. Can either of you address that?
Go ahead. I have not heard that before. I'd be interested to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I've had two climate change experts now tell me that Syria over the last 5 years has been in the midst of the worst drought that they've had in over 1,000 years, and that's driving much of the conflict. But and they ran out of wheat, and the government used to subsidize wheat. They used to actually export wheat. They no longer do. But I was just curious.
Yeah, I can jump in on the weather element. I know we talked to Andrew Harper, who oversees the entire UN operation within Jordan for the UNHCR, and he was saying one of the biggest things you're having problems with in the northern part of Syria are incredible rainfall. We were there. It was still actually quite hot during the day, but at night it got so cold. You begin to realize this is a country that is not exempt from snowfall. That's something that causes a lot of issues at the refugee camps. But just talking to people at food markets within Zaatari camp, people were complaining about the prices for certain staples. And the World Food Program escort, who was there with us, said essentially, it's true, there is a price difference. We're not able to drive down the prices so much in these markets in Jordan because, by comparison, Syria is the breadbasket of the region. It's the place, where prices can be very low, and they're additionally discounted by the Assad government, or at least were back in the day. So people have expectations that really it's just impossible to meet in their host country of Jordan.
Very.
I would add that I think you also saw a similar situation in Egypt, where bread was subsidized, and economic factors certainly had a big impact on why people were standing up against that government.
Right, right. And you wonder, throughout the Middle East, to what extent there's like really subtle things like, weather patterns changing, areas becoming wetter or drier than they used to be, and that changing their ability to produce food, how that is happening. Sunday, I spent part of Sunday with a friend of mine who spends part of the year in Israel, and he said that they're getting a lot more rain than they usually get, which is arguably a good thing, but that means that probably someplace else it's a lot drier. I mean, we're seeing these changing weather patterns here in the United States. Half of our counties last year declared a weather emergency of one kind or another, which is pretty unusual. So anyhow, I was just wondering about that. Did you guys want to talk about things beyond Jordan and Turkey and Syria, or is that in other words, was there a talk radio news report in here, or shall we continue talking about this? Because I find this fascinating.
This is the bulk of material that is occupying our brains, even though we've come back.
Okay.
We really still have so much.
So what's your sense of where the situation in Syria is going to go, and what is the impact that these refugees in Jordan and Turkey are having on the political and military dynamic in the region?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, if you look at a lot of what the State Department is pushing for at the moment and, a lot of activists and other people, what they're really trying to push for at the moment is access to provide humanitarian aid to a lot of these communities inside of Syria that are under siege. There are roughly, I think, 2.5 million Syrians in the suburbs around Damascus who are surrounded by regime forces. And the regime has been very restrictive in the amount of aid that they're allowing to be passed through via WFP, via the International Committee of the Red Cross. A lot of humanitarian organizations have been asking for access, and they've been refusing. Now, I did a little story on Wad Amia, which is a little town north of Damascus where children are eating leaves and adults are eating leaves to get by. The children are being starved to death, and adults as well. So within Syria, there are these sort of humanitarian access questions are being the real focal point for a lot of people in the opposition. I think because they realize that things politically are not going anywhere.
Right.
In terms of any economy.
And Luke, do you think, Assad is still young and healthy, relatively speaking. I think he's in his 50s. How's this going to resolve itself? Any sense of that in the last 10 seconds here?
As we hear at the UN, that's my beat there. They keep saying you can try to approach the humanitarian issue, but there's no humanitarian solution here. It could only be a political solution. So, unfortunately, you try to do your best on provision of aid, but beyond that, I think we're still in a waiting game for a political solution.
So it's either going to be diplomacy or war. Hopefully, diplomacy will win. Zach and Luke, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Good to speak to you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And the story of Michael Hastings is a fascinating one. The story of what he was investigating is perhaps even more important. Carl Gibson has been looking into this and done some just brilliant reporting. Interesting piece over at Occupy.com, Who Killed Michael Hastings? And perhaps, in my mind, even more important, why. Carl Gibson is on the line with us. Occupy.com is the website. Hey, Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Can you recap for our listeners who may not be familiar with the name Michael Hastings, just the elevator speech, the story in a capsule?
Sure. Michael Hastings was an investigative reporter for Rolling Stone magazine. He authored the report in 2010 that was responsible for General Stanley McChrystal getting fired. He was overseeing all U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan up until that point, and was also the former commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, which encompasses Army Rangers, Navy SEALs.
The general was, not the reporter, right?
Yeah, right.
And this reporter got him fired. Michael Hastings got General Stanley McChrystal fired with his report. So then what happened?
So just about 4 months ago, his brand new 2013 Mercedes-Benz C250 Coupe, it was seen crossing the Melrose intersection in the Hancock Park neighborhood on Highland Avenue, and a witness who saw the crash from beginning to end said it bounced three times, it accelerated rapidly, and slammed into a palm tree where it exploded almost on impact, and he said even first responders couldn't even approach the car for a while because it kept exploding. Now, this is really weird because just before that happened, Michael Hastings, he was actually trying to get off the grid. He told his colleagues at BuzzFeed in an email that he was working on a really big story and was going to get off the radar for a little while, and he cited fears over federal agents actually interviewing his close friends and family.
So there might be an assumption that he was actually assassinated or that his car was tampered with in some way?
Yeah, LA Weekly, they did a profile of Hastings and his life just before the crash. They had reported through talking to his neighbor, Jordana Thigpen, whom he was really close to. Jordana Thigpen actually said that Hastings was really scared and wanted to leave town after he read about the DOJ seizing AP phone records and after reading about all of what Edward Snowden had leaked, and he was convinced he was under surveillance. And in fact, the night of the crash, he unsuccessfully tried to borrow his neighbor's Volvo because he was afraid that his car had been hacked.
Hacked?
There's actually a computer science professor at UC San Diego who hacked into modern car systems from all manufacturers. And most of these modern cars from 2008 and onward are equipped with a computer system. So when you tap on your accelerator or on your brake, you're actually just telling a computer what you want the car to do. And so what this professor did, Stephen Savage, he figured out how to hack into one of these computer systems from 1,000 miles away and take over everything in the drivetrain, including, you know, acceleration and brakes. And, you know, it was really strange because Michael Hastings' friend, the staff sergeant Joe Biggs, said that Hastings drove like a grandma, and all of his friends and family said the same thing. So for him to be driving erratically like that was very out of character for him. Hmm. Now, you know, I wanted to add to that, Richard Clark, he was the counterterrorism chief under the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. He actually said at the end of an interview with Huffington Post that the car that Hastings was driving and the crash itself looked a lot like a car cyber attack.
A cyber attack. So, okay, so what was Michael Hastings investigating that either was so big that it drove him to some kind of insane suicide, or was so big that it caused somebody to hack his car and kill him, or was just coincidentally being investigated at a time that his brand new Mercedes decided to freak out?
Yeah, the story he was working on that he told his colleagues about and you know said that he was trying to get off the radar for was actually about CIA Director John Brennan in his capacity as the Obama administration's point man for basically leading the witch hunt on investigative journalists. And this is according to an email from Stratfor, which is a CIA-connected private security firm. In one of the many emails from Stratfor leaked by WikiLeaks, an internal email between Stratfor staff says, and in fact confirms, that Brennan was behind those witch hunts of investigative journalists. So the story that Hastings was working on, sadly, we'll never get to read his final version of it, although I hear one of his colleagues at Rolling Stone is going to try to finish it for him. But it'd be really interesting to know what Hastings saw that spooked him so much, and also why his car exploded in such a weird fashion, because you know, I had talked to a Mercedes-Benz Long Beach dealer who assured me up and down that the brand-new model C250 coupes were very well-built and, in fact, when they crashed, would fold in like an accordion and the engine would drop down to protect the driver, whereas Hastings' car exploded on impact and actually ejected its engine 200 feet, and there are pictures that, you know, confirm where the engine landed.
Isn't this the sort of thing where, you know, a lawsuit against Mercedes for bad design or something like that would provoke a really serious inquiry?
You know, it would. I don't know if anyone's taken that route yet. I know Mercedes has been, you know, they've been really...
It was having Audi like a decade ago, remember?
Yeah, I think Audi bought Volkswagen, and they might have bought Mercedes too. I don't know, but those are all German cars.
But, I mean, Audi had there was a story about a decade, maybe it was longer than that ago, where people were alleging that the cars were accelerating when they hit the brake, and you know, Audi ended up re-engineering their computer system over and over and over again. Their sales took a really bad hit for a year because 60 Minutes did a show on it. Ultimately, you know, the conclusion was that people were actually hitting the gas pedal, thinking they were hitting the brake, as far as anybody could tell. And I think they redesigned the relationship of the gas pedal and the brake to each other physically in space, you know, where your feet hit them to fix that problem. But this was it might have even been 20 years ago. It was a long time. It was a while ago. I mean, it might have been, you know, when you were young enough that you weren't paying attention. But I remember it quite well. But
I spoke with Professor Savage at UCSD. He specifically said that this was something that applied to all manufacturers and that these manufacturers have acknowledged that cybersecurity is something they need to take very seriously and recognize that there are vulnerabilities in these computer systems where they can be hacked from the outside.
Right, right. So where do we go with this information, Carl Gibson?
I would hope that more people like you, Tom, and like Abby Martin on RT, who I talked to last night, that more people in the media start to raise these questions, because when you just look a little closer at the official narrative, you can see how poorly constructed it is and how many holes there are. The LAPD says there's no foul play, but, you know, clearly looking into, you know, how the car exploded, the circumstances surrounding Hastings' death, and, you know, it just the how well-timed it was that, you know, he's working on this big story, and it just seems like for to call this an open shut case is really suspect in and of itself. So I hope that more people start to ask questions and, you know, start to challenge this official narrative a little bit and push back and try to find out what really happened to Michael Hastings.
If this is genuinely a Karen Silkwood moment, is there somebody besides the government involved? I mean, 70% of the NSA's budget is outsourced to private contractors. Could it have been that Hastings was looking into a private corporation or perhaps even a transnational corporation?
Well, I spoke with Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks, who is a close friend of Hastings, and he said that you know, before and after every program where Hastings was a guest, they would talk a lot about, you know, Hastings' time embedded in Afghanistan. And he mentioned that there were a lot of private contractors there who really didn't like Michael at all. And in fact, in his book, he talked about being approached by one of Stanley McChrystal's aides, who was just, you know, joking around with him. And he said, you know, if we don't like what you write about us, we'll hunt you down and kill you. And Hastings later wrote, he said, you know, I never took that seriously because whenever I was around a group of people whose job it was to, you know, kill people, then one of them would usually mention they're going to kill me. But I think Hastings was onto something. And like you said, we've outsourced a lot of our military and intelligence budgets. There are a million people like Edward Snowden out there with access to all kinds of information.
Yeah, it's amazing. Carl Gibson, you can read it over at Occupy.com. Thanks, Carl.
Oh, thank you, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's an amazing story. It's one of those genuine head-scratchers. This generation's Karen Silkwood, Michael Hastings. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? Andrew? Oh, you got your TV on. Andrew, I'm going to put you on hold. You're going to have to turn off your TV and listen to your telephone if you're going to go on the air here. Carson in Wallace, North Carolina. Hey, Carson, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
You're welcome, Tom. Hi. I wanted to correct a statement you made last Friday concerning a woman who called in that was just about hysterical about this Medicare Advantage. She, I don't know if you remember, she said she owned like 80 acres of land and a homestead. And she was scared to death that if she signed up for Medicaid, it was going to take it away from her.
Right. Now, let's be clear. This is Medicaid, not Medicare Advantage.
Right. Medicare pays 80%. Medicaid is the one that falls in and pays the 20% that Medicare does not pay.
No. I'm sorry. You're wrong. Medicaid is a completely separate program from Medicare. Medicare is
right,
a program.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree, but if you get Medicare only, you're only going to get 80% of your doctor bills and your hospital bills paid.
That's right. And then you can buy a Medigap policy to fill in that 20%, or you can buy a Medicare Advantage program, which will cover as much as you want to pay for, and they contract with Medicare. But that has nothing to do with Medicaid. Medicaid is insurance for people who are under 65 who are poor. And
it will pay the 20% that Medicare does pay. I'm sure of that.
It may if you're genuinely poor. I mean, but that is not what she was talking about.
Yes, exactly. Well, that was her situation. But here's the situation that I'm concerned about.
Okay.
I'm afraid that she misinformed thousands of people because she made the statement that she was afraid it was going to take away everything she owned, her 80 acres of land, her homestead, and all that.
Right.
And then you asked her to read you the letter, which I was so glad that you asked her to read you the letter. But in the letter, it explained exactly what that was, but somehow you missed it, Tom. And because the letter plainly stated that this Medicaid payback or Medigap payback, depending on which state you're in, what they call it.
Right.
It only concerns people who have listed or lived in assisted living home, like a nursing home.
Right.
If you have not lived in assisted care living, you do not have to pay any amount back to Medicaid. No doctor bills or no hospital bills. You do not have to pay one penny of that back to Medicaid. It only comes into effect if you have had to go.
If you go to a nursing home.
Assisted care living.
Right. Okay. My brother cared for my mother in her last years, and she died in his home, my brother Stan. And I remember a conversation that we had about, you know, nursing homes expenses and my dad's estate and everything else, and I never quite understood what was going on. You just clarified it for me, Carson. Now it all makes sense.
She's fine. Anybody that wants to go on Medicaid or the Medicaid expansion plan is fine, and they should not have to worry about losing their home or their property that they might want to will to their children or spouse or whatever. That
right.
Should not worry about that. I have experience in this.
Okay. Carson, thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate it. It is really an honor to hang out with people who know more than I do. Thank you. We'll be right back. Just a reminder that we are, it's our annual fundraiser for the Salem Children's Village and Hunter School, a program up in New Hampshire for kids on the autistic spectrum, by and large, who are having really, really hard time making it through life. And they need your help. We're trying to put a new roof on one of the houses and get generators for the houses because as the storms are getting worse and worse, they lose electricity so often up there. And the toll-free number for you to make a contribution is 800-897-8358. It's 100% tax deductible. It's a 501c3 charity. It's a program for kids that my wife Louise and I started back in 1978, and it's still running. You can check them out. Their website is hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org. And they, you know, both programs, it's all one organization, and they operate on the same property. And, worth checking out. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, you wanted to weigh in on the how do we pay for transportation discussion.
Yeah, well, one of the things your guest mentioned was that we have not had an increase in ridership. Well, I think a lot of it's been due to we're building really stupid systems in many cases. One is, like here in Denver, if you had like four people wanting to drive like 10 miles, it's going to cost you about four times as much to ride light rail as to drive. And so we need fares that like a scale for families and things like that,
right,
rather than just playing a flat fee for everybody. Also, they build these decorative transit shelters that don't protect from the weather, but they look nice.
Right.
But there are great alternatives, things we haven't done here. It's like you go to Holland. They have completely separate bike roads. You cannot walk on them. Here on bike paths, you got pedestrians all the time.
Yeah, I've seen that. I saw that in Denmark, too.
Yeah, they're not, the bike paths here are not designed by people who ride bikes. It's amazing when you ride them to have like, 110 degree turns sometimes, things like that.
Right.
But one of the real answers is BRT, and that's bus rapid transit. You have dedicated bus lines where it's like light rail, where you've got dedicated line, but buses can drive on it. They're great advantages. Like in Brazil, they get a greater passenger density than they do with rail. You can have mixed technology, so you can have a diesel bus and an electric bus in the same lane.
So basically, it's a road that is only for the buses.
Yes, but the beauty of it is, it also the bus can then leave that road, so you can instead, like with light rail, where if you go 20 miles, you might have to get on a bus to get to the light rail, then get off the light rail and get on the bus again.
Right.
You can take the bus on. All the way. So you might have no transfers, or you might have two transfers with light rail.
Right.
It costs less. You can build it much quicker because, you can just take existing road and say, okay, this is a bus lane now.
Right. So presumably the buses may meander about in the more suburban areas or rural areas, pick up passengers in different places. And then when they get into areas where there's high levels of traffic congestion, they've got their dedicated bus-only lanes, and they just go zipping through those areas in ways that a subway would or a light rail would. And then when they get back out into the less congested areas, then they can drop you off and within five blocks of your house.
Exactly. And so there are many other advantages, but especially the mixed technology, because when you do light rail, you're stuck with the type of technology you chose. Well,
right.
The new one comes out, you can't just put it on. And you also can't use an old technology because, say when football games are happening.
Right.
You might want to bring old buses online and, use them.
Right.
Things like that.
Now, the upside of light rail versus buses, though, is that the resistance of steel to steel on a rail is much, much lower than the resistance of rubber to asphalt with a bus. And because you have a whole bunch of cars back to back, you create one slipstream for a train. There's only one set of wind resistance, whereas with buses, each bus, unless they're within 5 feet of each other, each bus is hitting its own wind resistance, so they get less gas mileage as well. Thoughts on that?
Yes, there are some things like that, but the key point is you have to look at passenger miles per gallon.
Right.
And while you have may have efficient or per what energy unit.
Right.
Well, you may have the efficiency of the trains as you speak. If you don't have the people riding them, the efficiency decreases.
Right. Good point.
And again, look, we can look at countries like Brazil and other Latin American countries and around the world where they've used BRT, and they're getting incredible passenger densities. Mm-hmm. So the net result, as far as I'm aware right now, is actually the efficiency does improve because of the number of passengers are actually riding.
So it goes beyond light rail unless the light rail is full.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, that's the thing is we see a lot of light rail trains go by, especially at night, with hardly anybody on them. And, light rail is great in certain situations. I'm not totally against it. It's just we have an alternative we can build much faster because you can bring in a bus rapid transit system very quickly where light rail will take years and years.
Right. You just have to grab a couple of roads and say, okay, we're redesignating these roads, and then, boom, you're off to the races. Got it. Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Mike in Seattle, you had some thoughts on bribing kids to read?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. So you were looking for a rebuttal, and what came to my mind was that since education is a mandatory thing that kids have to do, when you tie a paid incentive to it, then the analogy is almost like paid labor again. For example, why not just have Head Start programs for trade schools and early manufacturing skills and pay kids to go into the factories? And, that's an extreme example, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's how our modern education started, was Maria Theresa, the Queen of Austria back in the 17th century, in the 1600s, I think it was, or maybe the early 1700s, started what were called Spinnenschulen in Austria, where you brought your children to basically a factory, and for half a day they would spin cloth, and then half the day they would be taught. And the teaching was the payment for spinning the cloth. So your kids never made any money, but your kids also got educated. And that, over time, has evolved into our modern education system, interestingly enough. But that's an interesting reframe for it. Mike, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The Hunter School needs your help. It's 800-897-8358. Find the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. 22%. Well, by the way, Hunter School needs your help. We're doing our annual fundraiser for Hunter School, trying to raise enough money to put a new roof on one of the houses and get generators to the various houses. The toll-free number to donate is 800-897-8358, 800-897-8358, 8358. Okay, proof that what I've been saying for years and years, and I originally stole this meme from Mike Dirks, giving credit where credit is due. He used to be our program director at KPOJ in Portland. Mike said, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And it was such a great line. I said, may I take that and run with it? And he's like, sure. So here it just now the study has come out. 22% of Americans identify themselves as libertarian or leaning libertarian. This is the Public Religion Research Institute. Only 7% are consistent libertarians, 15% quote lean libertarian. 94% are non-Hispanic whites, 62% are under 50, and 68% are men. So they tend to be white young men. And here's the kicker, 5% identify themselves as Democrats, 45% identify themselves as Republicans. Told you so. Libertarians are Republicans who want to get laid and smoke dope. It's just real simple. Okay, and the Oklahoma Supreme Court definitively ruled today that a restrictive state abortion law is unconstitutional as follows the Texas, a federal court in Texas, ruling that Texas's court that Wendy Davis successfully, the court ruling striking down the Texas anti-abortion law, that Wendy Davis successfully filibustered, and then Rick Perry brought Congress, or brought the state Senate and House back into a whole brand new special session to reconsider the legislation all over again. And they did it in a way that Wendy Davis couldn't filibuster it, and they passed it with basically just the Republican votes. So federal court yesterday in Texas said that law was unconstitutional. These are basically called trap laws. These are laws that make it impossible to run an abortion clinic, basically. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled today the same thing. It restricts the long-respected medical discretion of physicians. In other words, it is government inserting itself between a woman and her doctor. And I find it very interesting that the people who claim to be conservatives and want small government, apparently small enough, you know, and Grover Norquist had that horrible, you know, small enough to drown in a bathtub. Apparently they just want the government to be small enough to fit in a woman's uterus. I mean, it sounds pretty gross, but I don't know how to put it beyond that. It's like, that's bizarre. It's just bizarre. Mitch in Sycamore, Illinois. Hey, Mitch, you're an engineer and you know about the computers like the one that...
Yes, this is as of 2007, October. All factories in Michigan and Ohio were shut down waiting for me to drive out there to reprogram these units. If they could have done it remotely, they would have. These factories, minimum, were $20,000 a minute waiting for me. A lot of factories. My boss was sent to another couple of states. His boss was sent to another couple of states. There weren't that many people that could go in and correct these units. Right. I'm not saying the guy wasn't set up, wasn't murdered. I'm just saying what he said about the programming was not accurate. It was, as of 2007, the two buses for the computer systems were separate. There was something that you had to do within the car to actually reprogram these units.
Right.
And that's why they had to shut down the factories to wait for me to get there.
Okay, well, it's been 5 years since then, 6 years since then. And
yeah, but I'm curious about a murder that happened in 2004.
Right.
So it would have been a technology that our team would have been familiar with.
Okay. I'm curious if the LoJack systems, which can lock a car, right? They can put the brakes on a car.
Can lock a car. I don't believe the brakes can shut off the engine.
Okay, they can shut off the engine. So they, but a LoJack system could not accelerate a car.
I don't believe the LoJack could accelerate. There are certain things that they really want to avoid. Again, that was not what I was there for.
Right.
I was there specifically. There was a programming issue, and they could not program without a specially trained engineer.
Right.
At that time, there were six of us.
So you're quite skeptical of the idea that Michael Hastings' car was hacked.
If it was, they had to have done something to add an extra piece of equipment.
So they had to have modified his car. And he had expressed...
If they modified his car, I could say it's possible.
Yeah.
I don't want to see somebody's conspiracy theory shot down because something's infeasible.
Right.
Just because they're gone to a thing. Yes, there are computers in the car. And again, I say computers. It's not one.
Right.
There's two buses in the modern system. Just because originally they did address that they were afraid that somebody might reprogram one of the buses.
Very interesting.
So the door lock systems is separate from the engine control system.
Yeah. Okay. Mitch, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the information.
Right.
You know, I don't know where to take that or what to do with it. I'm just looking at this whole thing going, wow. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk about the, first of all, I agree with Louise that it's not a good idea to pay the kids to get good grades and why Newt Gingrich is wrong, and help you get a rebuttal for the idea that what he's proposing is the same as going to work, and that's why paying kids to read books is a good idea.
Okay.
Well, you know, what we're talking about here is behavior reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two kinds, which is positive reinforcement. You know, the doggy does a trick, he gets a treat. And there's negative reinforcement, which is not punishment, This just means, for instance, you get your homework done. I won't. I'll let you stay out later on Saturday night. You know, I'll lift your curfew a little bit.
But that's still positive reinforcement, isn't no. Negative reinforcement basically pain? I mean, isn't everything either pleasure or pain?
No. Negative reinforcement is taking a negative thing away.
Taking a positive thing away. You mean?
If negative reinforcement means that when you do the behavior, I take a restriction away. I don't make you take out the garbage. You get your homework done every day this week. I won't make you. I'll take out the garbage. I won't make you do it. Punishment is pain. Punishment does not reinforce any behavior. It only stops the behavior.
I get your distinction. Okay, so you're saying that there are two ways to reinforce behavior and one way to stop behavior. Pain is the way to stop behavior. The two ways to reinforce behavior are either to give somebody an explicit reward or stop withholding a reward.
No, take a negative thing away. Negative reinforcement is a little more complicated. But anyway, let's move on with it.
Okay.
We're talking also about the positive.
Right.
Read a book, you get the money.
Right.
The problem with this kind of reinforcement is, in this case, is two things. If you focus on the money, Newt Gingrich is wrong. There is another way for a girl to get money in the ghettos of our cities, and they find out, like turn to prostitution and sell drugs, stuff like that. So, or another case, not so nefarious, is if you give the kid $100 because he gets good grades, once he finds another way to get $100, like maybe get a job.
That, right.
You see, you're focusing on the reward, and
right.
now he doesn't have time to study.
Right.
So the way you use a reward, and this is the problem, is you have to gradually take it away. So when the doggy rolls over, you don't give him a treat every time. You gradually start taking that away. And then you shift the reward to praise. All good dog trainers use praise. And that's why the best thing for kids in school is to praise their performance and not pay them.
Right.
And this is what the difference is in the going to work analogy is, because if I start paying you only once in a while, you're not going and then stop paying you at all and then just saying, Tom, you're such a nice guy, you're not going to come into work.
Well, this job, actually, I would, and it's one of the reasons why I work a 12-hour day, because it doesn't seem like work to me. But I think for most people, that's true.
Yeah, because it's not a behavior reinforcement. The pay is just a quid pro quo. It's something for something. You're not doing a behavior reinforcement anymore.
Yeah, in fact, I would add, I did this show for 3 years for nothing. It's first 3 years.
Well, I lost money.
Yeah. In fact, we did lose money. We spent about a third of our, maybe a little more than that, of all of our retirement savings just getting this show launched over the first 3 years.
But eventually you knew, and because it's something you love, you know.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the most powerful reinforcer is the praise. So like I said, the best thing you can do when your kids come home with a good report card is to say, you're going to spend time with us. Louise and I are going to take you out to dinner and tell you how much we love you,
right?
And that's the big modifier, and that's what's wrong is in the cities where we have family breakdown and so on. The kids don't get that, so they do find another way to get $162.
Right, $163 or whatever it was, and $166 wasn't it? Because there's 83 books, yeah. In any case, your point is well made, and you're absolutely right, Paul. You're absolutely right, and you've completely recalibrated this in my brain. Thank you for that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Paul's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. What do you expect? He's listening to this program. We have the smartest listeners in the world. I am so honored to hang out with you guys.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Not to mention the smart people in the chat room and the smart people here in my studio, and Shane and Danielle and Jim, and it's just incredible. And welcome back, Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
How are you? Sorry about what happened earlier. I lost voice feed on my phone completely. I couldn't. The Medicare Advantage program. Actually, Mike or Mark Antonio had a nice segment about what he called, I think, like the perfect scam.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could have him on the show.
Who is this?
Mike or Mark Papantonio?
Oh, Mike Papantonio. He says Medicare Advantage is the perfect scam. I'll have to ask him about that. Okay.
yeah, you may not agree with him 100% about how much corruption there is amongst Republicans and Democrats. But anyway, here is how he summarized it. Maybe it's a two-part thing. Number one, you need to have a corrupt Congress in order to perform the perfect scam, and we have that. Republicans and Democrats, or Republicans only, we may disagree on that.
No, I'll acknowledge that there's corrupt Democrats, and the system is corrupt.
Yeah. So you go to Congress, and you say, we are a private insurance company. We want you to pay us 117% of what you would pay on the average to a Medicare recipient. And in exchange for this, we're going to offer an advantage to the seniors beyond what Medicare offers. And the corrupt Congress says yes, so they get 117%. And part two of the scam is that most of the times the advantage they offer is a free health care, a free membership in, you know, in a gym or somewhere. And why it is a big
scam. Or a free membership to AARP.
But why the scam is so big is because a Medicare recipient could cost Medicare very little if they are healthy and they go to a health club. And they could cost Medicare 10 times if they're really sick with lungs and heart and cancer illness and so forth. And what private insurance companies in that way ends up doing is selecting the healthiest patients to enroll at a 117% rate. And leave the very sick to the federal Medicare that...
So Medicare Advantage companies can turn you down?
Well, they don't... I don't know if they can turn you down, but I know from what I think is that if you are offering a free membership, and I don't know if they seek every single Medicare patient.
Right.
But if you are going to... if you are going to take the Medicare Advantage because of the gym, you're probably very healthy.
Yeah. Very interesting.
But if you're not healthy.
That's very interesting. Or the Medicare Advantage may just have a cap that they pay out, and after that, Medicare picks it up. And so by the time you get sick, Medicare Advantage is no longer covering you, and it's rolling over into Medicare. Could that be?
It could well be. Year after year, I think they have to re-enroll, I think, anyway. Like, you don't stay with the private Medicare Advantage plan forever. I think you have to re-enroll every year.
Right.
And who knows what happens the next year if you get real free.
Right. So what Obamacare is doing is they're dialing back on that 117% payment over the next 10 years.
I think it's better to dial back to zero yesterday because that's a big scam. And what's happening is the federal Medicare program, the government program, is really getting to spend a lot of money on the patients who are not as healthy.
Right. I got it. And meanwhile, United Healthcare makes enough money to pay their CEO $1 billion. Andrew, brilliant. Thank you very much for educating me. I appreciate it. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Linda in Cave Junction, Oregon. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener and first-time caller.
Thank you.
I have the Advantage program.
Mm-hmm.
I have Health Net. And I happened to talk to my insurance lady this morning and finalize mine before your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I pay zero above what they take for Medicare.
Okay.
Now, that money somehow then goes... My insurance agent gets some, and then...
Right. Well, the earlier caller said that the way the deal works is that the health insurance companies lobbied Congress to pay them 117% of what Medicare costs, and they would offer an advantage. And so if you're paying the same as Medicare, that 17 additional percent is the profit that the health insurance company is making for administering your program.
It could be. Now, the reason I do it, I am low-income person. I'd say my share, because I'm on the very bottom program.
Sure.
I probably pay the 20% like Medicare on my bills.
Right.
But what happens is after $3,500, I don't pay anything.
Right. So you've got
if
that.
If I was on Medicare and I had a $100,000 bill, I'm going to pay 20%.
Unless you get a Medigap policy. Now, there is a separate kind of health insurance called Medigap that covers the holes in Medicare, as opposed to...
Now, that's possible.
Yeah, which is very different from Medicare Advantage. But Medicare Advantage is basically the government... You know, the reason it works out being a good deal for you is because the government, that is you and me, the taxpayers, are subsidizing the health insurance companies. Whereas with Medigap, mm-hmm. I don't believe that they're subsidizing the health insurance companies. I think it's just, you know, fill-in-the-gap insurance.
And I would have to probably pay for that.
Right. And my sense of what's going on with Obamacare is that over time, that 117% payment that the Medicare is making to the private health insurance company so that they can make a profit off this thing is going to be dialed back. That's that missing money that Betsy was hysterical about in the early part of the show. And so more and more people are going to drop the Medicare Advantage programs. The health insurance companies are going to lose the profit that they're making on those, which is basically just corporate welfare, you know, government welfare for corporations. And people are going to go back to having Medicare and buying a Medigap policy to fill in the 20%, to fill in the hole, if that makes sense. And that won't be that
it
expensive.
It makes sense. But for me, this is the cheapest way for me to go and still cover my ass.
Right, right. Metaphorically speaking, I got it. Linda, thank you very much for the call. Maybe physically, I don't know. Marcia in Smyrna, Georgia. Hey, Marcia, you wanted to talk about bribing kids?
Well, I wanted to talk about bribing kids, but you need to know that the gentleman that you talked to a moment ago gave you a whole lot of misinformation about Advantage, Medicare Advantage.
The 117%?
A whole lot of misinformation.
Okay.
So I don't know about that piece, but you don't have to re-up every year. If you're dissatisfied with your company, you can change.
Okay.
But if you like where you're with, you could stay there.
Okay. Well, I got to learn more about this. We're going to get Mike Papantonio on to talk about it because apparently he's an expert on this.
I'm in the middle of it right now, so I know how it works.
All right.
As for bribing kids, when it really doesn't analogize to going to work, because you don't go to work to be paid. You go to work to earn money so that you can then support your family, eat, whatever it is you need to do. That's different from giving a kid money for a good grade.
Right.
Giving a kid money for a good grade is what lobbyists do. You do this for me, I'll pay you.
Right.
You don't want them to learn to work for you. You want them to learn to work for themselves. So you set up a kind of mini economy. And I've seen it done where economists who work with kids set up a whole allowance system. But it's almost like a bonus system. Mm-hmm. You want to work towards something, I will help you get there. And here's how I'll help you. You
right.
apply yourself and you do, you know, X, Y, Z well in whatever. Ace the next test or whatever it is, and I will help you toward that goal this much.
Right. Well, we did that with one of our kids with getting a car when she was 17 or 18, and we concluded that it was a big mistake and we didn't do it with the other two. I think they're feeling like they got the short end of the stick on that one.
But. Again, it all depends on how you set it up and what the kids think they're doing. What lobbyists do is they go in and they say, I'll pay you if you'll do this for me.
All right.
That's not what we're talking about. If you set it up that way, then it's bribery.
Right.
If you set it up that I really, you know, I want you to apply yourself and I want you to learn that the way you will make it through life is to apply yourself to what's important so that you can then have the things, you know, that you need and or want.
Right.
That's the lesson that we need to be teaching.
Yeah, I agree. Marcia, very well said. Thank you very much for the call and thanks for sharing that. We just have 1 minute left in the show. I want to try and get some more calls in here. Pam in Long Beach, California. I misunderstood something about Kaiser.
Well, number one, Kaiser is a nonprofit.
Right.
Number two, Kaiser's regular Medicare is called Medicare Advantage. If you want to buy the little extra thing with the dental and vision and all that, that's Advantage Plus.
Right.
For Kaiser.
But the Medicare Advantage program is subsidized by the federal government.
Yeah, it's their basic program, and the co-payments are going up next year. Mm-hmm. I noticed the lab work is going from $20 to $30.
Right.
That's yuck. But, yeah. And Kaiser is a nonprofit, and I have to tell you that they do things. Well, they learned a long time ago that it's cheaper to keep people healthy than you're treated on this side.
Yeah, Kaiser's always been, you know, one of the kind of shining stars in our healthcare system, one of the examples of how to do things right. I do remember that. In fact, back in the late 70s when we started the Salem Children's Village, I knew Ben Feingold quite well, and he worked at Kaiser, and he was a physician there, and we had conversations about Kaiser at that time because it was new and innovative in 1970. Pam, thank you for the call. Thanks for the information. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the news and information the corporate news media really would rather you didn't know, plus a healthcare coverage success story. We'll tell you what one Illinois community is doing, and innocent civilians talk about what it's been like to get attacked by drones. We'll talk with Robert Greenwald of Brave New Films. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. The Hunter School fundraiser, 800-897-8358. Tag, you're it, 800-897-8358.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.